It was sleeping. So, oh, good, thank you. The 3 points, introducing directly the face of Rigpa itself. Second, decide upon one thing and one thing only. Third, confidence directly in the liberation of rising thoughts. Then the commentary using Pato Rinpoche's commentary. Some people may have read a very thick book, nice book, called Words of My Perfect Teacher. Kind of Pato Rinpoche's Nundro, in a sense. So introducing directly the face of Rigpa is getting us to recognize our actual lived experience in the presence. There was one time, I think it was a Saturday, toward the end of a meditation, I let out kind of a yogic yell a little bit, "Pay." Like that. That's kind of traditional. I don't think I announced I was going to do it, you know. If you do, it kind of loses some of its, not entirely, but Pato Rinpoche's commentary, called A Special Teaching of the Wise and Glorious King. I'll read out. Homage to the Master, the view is Longchen Ramjab, infinite vast expanse. Meditation is Kensei Ozer, rays of wisdom and love. Action is Gyawa Nyugyo, that of the Bodhisattvas. One who practices in such a way may well attain enlightenment in this very life. And even if not, what happiness, what joy, alala. Introducing directly the face of Rigpa. As for the view, Longchen Rabjam, three statements strike the vital point. First, relax and release your mind. Neither is scattered nor concentrated, without thoughts. While resting in this even state, at ease, suddenly let out a mind-shattering pay. Fierce, forceful, and abrupt. Amazing. There's nothing there. Transfixed in wonder, struck by wonder, and yet all is transparent and clear. Fresh, pure, and sudden, so beyond description. Recognize this as the pure awareness of Dharmakaya. The first vital point is introducing directly the face of Rigpa in itself. So, reading this out too, you can consider like having a long reading transmission. Traditionally, particularly for Dzogchen and Mahamudra, any text you study, you should get the oral transmission of. That was easier kept when there wasn't the internet, you know, or even even books like we have, you know. But you want to actually hear it and hear it from a qualified teacher. Do we have to go around yelling? No. But generally, to be introduced, there's going to be something unexpected. Generally, to be introduced, there's going to be a kind of necessary dropping of I know what this is. So the awe and wonder that we see on sometimes Guru Rinpoche's Padmasambhava's face, just a little bit mouth open, eyes a little bit, demonstrate that kind of like that first, before at first experience, before we begin to tell the story about it or figure out what it was, go into duality. The path, though, is all of our experience is basically like that. We have no idea what's going on. And then we tell a story about it. The important part is, though, when we've done the practice, we could say mother clear light and child clear light come together. The child recognizes the mother and says, oh, so that's the true nature, before we go into explanation. The mother doesn't forget who the child is, right? The child forgets the mother. So the path is we're reuniting, you know, mother and child. We have to put ourselves into situations where we're not in control, where we're willing to be awkward. We're willing to experience something new. We're willing to surrender to wonder. Or the path becomes very much relative path of, I just want to know what experience I'm going to have. So that's the difficult part. We want to know what's going to happen before it happens. It's kind of self-secret, because even though we're explaining Dzogchen and Mahamudra, our own lived experience still comes as a huge surprise to us. Fortunately, wonderment and surprise, when integrated into our life, becomes gratitude. How do you know when you've met someone who's really practicing Mahamudra and Dzogchen? One way is that there's a sense of freshness combined with just a real sense of gratitude. Grateful people, you know. It's like very soft, generally. When someone has, like, they have the hardness, they're generally not going to be in gratitude, isn't that so? They may be a little arrogant, like, I figured something out. But when we just look at our original face of Rigpa, we realize we didn't produce it. We can't claim it as an accomplishment. We're just so incredibly grateful. Sometimes, you know, even bad accidents or extreme situations where we you know, get out of it. They're shocking, but then we feel a sense of gratitude. Have you ever felt that way? Like, wow. Instead of just feeling lucky or shocked, we go on to feel gratitude. But who knows, I might be yelling pay somewhere along the line. That'd be okay. You know? Sometimes people jump. I don't want any heart attacks. People suing. You yelled pay. That's American style. You know, like, no. I think in words of his, my perfect teacher, I think Patrimshi talks about his own realization experience with Dokensei. They're just kind of course, lots of practice, you know, so they're just kind of lying, looking up at the stars, and Kensei Rinpoche just says, do you see the stars? Do you hear the dog barking? And Pato Rinpoche had an awakening there. That's being very receptive, right? Because usually we just go, yeah, I see the stars, same stars, OC. Yeah, those are the stupid dogs barking. You don't hear it for the first time. But can you imagine like seeing something for the first time again? That's your own experience. That's the nature of Rigpa. It's like for the first time. Would we get anything done if we saw things for the first time? Yeah, we would, but it might be more interesting. Like, we'd go like, what are these? No, but what's that? You know, like, but with that immediate experience, we've built up the wisdom mind. We've done all the supportive practices, so we still have the prajna aspect of discriminating wisdom. I mean, we're not walking into walls and, you know, just kind of being a baby again. But there's the combination of discriminating wisdom and then primordial wisdom goes together. Then second, decide upon one thing and one thing only. This is, again, Patrimshi's text. Then, whether in a state of movement or stillness, of anger or attachment, happiness or sorrow, all the time in any situation, recognize that Dharmakaya you recognized before. Dharmakaya the Rigpa. And mother and child, clear light, already acquainted, will reunite. Rest in the aspect of awareness beyond all description. Stillness, bliss, and clarity disrupt them again and again. Suddenly striking with the syllable of skillful means and wisdom, with no difference between meditation and post-meditation, no division between sessions and breaks, always remain in this indivisible state. But until stability is attained, it is vital to meditate away from all distractions and busyness, practicing improper meditation sessions, all the time in any situation, abide by the flow of what is only Dharmakaya. Decide with absolute conviction that there is nothing other than this. The second vital point is decide upon one thing and one thing only. So in the retreat we did a few months ago, it was kind of easier because then we didn't feel we had to do anything, right? When you're on retreat and everything's kind of, the petty decisions go down, right? So retreat is easier, actually, right? Because you don't, you know, you actually don't have to decide so many things. So that's the benefit of the relative practice of retreat. So you can keep deciding, okay, this just my immediate pure awareness, that's it. I don't have to decide between my immediate pure awareness and what I'm going to wear this morning. that's what we do, right? Pure immediate experience and what should I have for dinner tonight, right? Usually we decide, well, it's more important what I decide for dinner tonight. I'll just leave my pure experience. So in retreat, we don't do that, you know. So for some people, it might be helpful to make a few comments about Paterim Shay's phrase or point, stillness, bliss, and clarity disrupt them again and again, suddenly striking with a syllable of skillful means and wisdom. So people think, well, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? Getting stillness, bliss, and clarity? Isn't the whole point? So why does he say disrupt them? Just to think about, I'll say why, but then you can ask questions in a minute. Yeah. Sometimes it's called stillness, bliss, and no thought. Before we have realizations, we're going to have experiences. Realizations are when we have the constant experiences where it becomes part of who we are. It becomes real. In other words, we can act on it. We can master it. It's real. Realizations are, you can do it under pressure. Like, we're all masters of something, right? So we're masters of a few things, many things, that in spite of all the pressures and craziness, we can do it, right? That's realization. You can do it under pressure. You can do it under adverse circumstances because it's integrated enough in your life. If it's just an experience, something like in Tibetan called nyam, then we can say, well, I had this really interesting experience, but I can't use it right now, you know, or it faded. Or we think we can use it, but outsiders can see, well, you may have thought you had some realization, but you're not using it. But at the same time, things start out as experiences, right? Glimpses. Here, of course, there's in stillness, blissfulness, clarity, or no thought. These are going to be powerful experiences. Experiences. Even at this level, where we're saying, okay, I'm a Dzogchenpa, whatever, we're going to attach to them, usually. We're going to say, this is it. But please remember what Third Karmapa said. If you have to say, this is it, in that way, that's not it. If you have to say, this is it, or that's not it. So that's not really recognition, like, oh, this is it. I got to hold on to that. Anybody ever had that experience? Like, you had some experience, and you got to go, I got to hold on to this, right? You're probably holding on to an experience, and it won't become a realization, because then it's become a memory that you're trying to reproduce. You do want to continually practice so that the experiences arise and become realizations. But when Rinpoche here is saying disrupt them again and again, it doesn't mean like get up from your cushion, get all distracted, and be stupid. That's what sometimes you'll go, I'm really doing the practice. Whenever I start getting calm or still or, you know, no thought, then I just quit. Okay. And I'm enlightened now. You know. So it does mean that we're not fixating on them. We're disrupting them through skillful means and wisdom. So we're recognizing, oh, okay, that's wonderful. Each new moment is a new moment, and each situation needs to be applied with a wisdom mind and a skillful mind, which means generally, this is good, but I need to deepen this. This is good, but how will this benefit others? This is good, but how does this lead to complete liberation? So we're disrupting it by releasing the fixation on having to own the experience. If you're really something, you don't need to own it, right? You don't need to say, yes, I have a patience badge over here, and that's me. You don't. If you're really patient, you don't need to own it, right? Well, we release the fixation that we have to maintain it, you know, the stillness, or maintain the clarity, or maintain the no thought. Release the, you know, that's one level of fixation, and then really have to release the fixation, like, now I'm a great yogi. So if you think you've realized something, then go back to counting your breath. you know, and then hang out with a good friend or a spouse or partner that's going, you know, tell you that you didn't fold up the hose correctly, you know. Or just come to Lion's Roar, somebody's, or the temple, someone's bound to tell you, oh, you got to do it this way. And then you go, well, no, I don't. I'm a Dzogchenpa. I don't have to do it. You know, I'm free. You know, then you realize, oh, I'm stuck. Okay. So they thought. So when we become fixated, don't become tricky with yourself. You know, you just count your breaths again, or do some, you know, help someone with some basic task, right? Seriously. So, that's why he's talking about wisdom and skillful means. Then third, confidence directly in the liberation of rising thoughts. Third point. At that point, whether attachment or aversion, happiness or sorrow, all momentary thoughts, each and every one, upon recognition, leave not a trace behind. Or recognize the Dharmakaya in which they are freed, and just as writing vanishes in water, on water, arising and liberation become natural and continuous. And whatever arises is food for the bare Rigpa emptiness. Whatever stirs in the mind is the inner power of Dharmakaya King, leaving no trace and innately pure. What joy! The way things arise may be the same as before, but the difference lies in the way they are liberated. That's the key. Without this, meditation is but the path of delusion. When you have it, there's non-meditation, the state of Dharmakaya. The third vital point is confidence directly in the liberation of rising thoughts. After one and two, you know, directly seeing nature mind and then liberating fixation, you know, we usually think, well, we're all done. You know, well, even first one, people, I recognize nature mind, I'm done. Or, yes, I'm not attached to my experience, I'm done, you know. People say that all the time. Yeah, I got in line, but I'm not attached, so that's enough. even after those states are experienced and somewhat mastered, we can get overwhelmed by the manifestations of mind, right? The expression of mind comes out in phenomena, you know, of course, outer phenomena, the mind waves of the ocean, you know, we see all kinds of phenomena, the temple, our bodies, but the trickiest phenomena are the thoughts and emotions, right? And even though thoughts and emotions are of the nature of mind, they're not quite the same as the Dharmakaya aspect. We get kind of traumatized by our own expression. This is an important point. So even though, you know, we've done a lot of practice, we tend to get kind of blown away by our own expression. The mind naturally expresses thoughts, so, you know, we could say, well, that's easy, or just realize that. But actually, when it happens, we get a little traumatized. Trauma is being overwhelmed, and we get a little overwhelmed. So the third point is, even though it appears that the sky is falling, it's just rising expression. It's just our expression. That's difficult, you know. I have an old friend up in outside of Reno that lives on a ranch, and been doing going back to when I studied with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and he always says, "Oh, you're such a grandmother," you know, because this third point is where lamas generally test students. You know, we're testing ourselves, and Sangha tests us, but after thinking we've attained some Shine or some Mahamudra Dzogchen, do we still get overwhelmed by our rising thoughts and emotions? Yeah. So it isn't here that we could say, we're not saying I'm never going to get overwhelmed, but that we still have confidence that this is the fact that they liberate themselves. We say that the just like riding on water. If we don't mess with it, you know, don't add more anger to it, or we don't try to deny it, or we don't act it out, we don't stuff it, then the expression will have its own natural rise and fall. We have confidence in that process. The confidence isn't like, if I get enlightened, realized, I'll never get pissed off again and never make a mistake. The confidence is that we understand the nature of the process. The waves will go down quite significantly, but the confidence doesn't mean, now I'm confident that I'll never get pissed off again. If you say to a teacher, like myself, I've attained humility, or I no longer am angry, what will happen? Yeah, or I'll get pissed off and see, you know. So I don't know. It's always an open secret, you know, because I've had in the past people come in to darshan. They're not the ones here today, you know, like, Lamala, I've attained humility. And seriously. And I kind of take that in, and then I go, you know, I don't immediately say, no, you haven't. You know, that would be a little too obvious. You know, we talk a little bit more, and then I start saying, you know, the way you did that in the past, that's really not very good. And then you kind of build up, you know, that way, being critical, right? If someone's really attained some humility, they would go, yeah, you're right. I kind of screwed up the last time, and thanks for pointing that out. And then the second time, when the Lama says, you know, just the other day when you did this, you really screwed up, and the person would still say, yeah, that's right. I really screwed up, and I could have done that better. Thanks for pointing that out. And the third time, the Lama says, you know, even right now, you know, you're not really paying attention very much, and you're into your ego. The person would go, yeah, you're right. I'm not paying attention. I'm really in my ego. Thank you for pointing that out. But instead, what usually happens is the person gets progressively pissed off, right? You know, it's like, how dare you criticize me three times in a row? So then, actually, if they're good practitioners, I'll say, well, where's the humility now, right? You know? happened lots of times, then the person goes, you were just testing me. And I go, well, if you knew I was just testing you, then why take the bait, right? So there's not much wisdom there, you know? So it's an open secret, right? I'm already telling you, right? But even when I tell people, like, well, you know, I might just, if you make claims about having attained a paramita of patience or something like that, you know, then of course, you know, you will be tested. But it doesn't matter if you tell people ahead of time, because they just do it. Okay, question time, then we'll sit. Yeah.
Can you just repeat this part where you said, if we don't add to it, add anger, respond to it, you kind of list it off, if we don't add to the,
Yeah. So, you know, usually when we're overwhelmed, we go into a trauma response. Generally, first flight, actually, then fight, then this freeze and forget, and then fabricate, I call it, and then finally fuck it, you know. So, if we don't go into a trauma response, we kind of ride the wave. You know, we're like the seagulls on the waves. You know, we're going to ride the wave. We know, we understand the nature of mind. We understand that actually the mind is going to, you know, have expression, and occasionally it will feel overwhelming. So, you know, we hang with it. You know, people have heard me say, it's okay to be on the roller coaster as long as the bar is down, you know? Because you don't want to make a claim like, I'll never get pissed again, or I'll never get hooked again, or something like that, right? I'll never want the chocolate cake again. We don't want to do that. We just understand that when we do get a little bit traumatized by our own action, but we recognize this is our own experience, this is our own expression of mind. We're not blaming. We always, you know, I say it too sometimes, but, you know, it's a fiction. You made me angry. That's a fiction, right? Total fiction. You know, so at least as Dharma practitioners, you know, we can say, well, I made myself angry by, you know, attaching, you know, to what you did. Yeah. So that confidence, but then the confidence that, okay, this is impermanent, right? Sometimes that's it. You know, this too will pass. Or I know the trajectory. I know there'll be an end to the ride, and I can lift the bar and go on another ride. But it amps it up when you feel like we've got to win, or we've then got to stamp it out or something. Yeah, like that. So that needs to be clear, because sometimes practitioners, you know, think, well, I've now a Buddha, an enlightened person, would never get upset, right? Even the Dalai Lama says he gets annoyed, right? Okay, so let's not go there. And frankly, I've been around my quota of really two incredible beings. Trungpa Rinpoche, Dalai Lama, Dujin Rinpoche, Dingo Kensei Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche, our own Jada Rinpoche, Chagud Tolko Rinpoche, my own teacher Lhasa Gyatso, Chogyi Rinpoche, you know, His Holiness Jigme Puntsok, you know, I mean, just guess what? You get to know everybody, and they're going to, you know. I've never met anybody. And if someone in the audience here knows somebody, like, I know someone who absolutely never, you could cut out their arm, then I want to go meet that person. So, but what I have noticed with all the wonderful teachers I've had is that, usually when they do get angry, that there's probably some kind of bodhisattva reason, even though they're irritated, you know. And they get over quickly, and it's not a hostile anger. It's just kind of a uprising. But yet, there's some disturbance, you know. If you tell a teacher, our beautiful abbot who was here, Ken Rinpoche, very peaceful, right? Just like Chenrezig, a really incredible teacher. But if Geshe Wangchuck, the administrator, came and said, you know what, we went to our bank in Mysore, Bank of India, and our freaking account's been wiped out. Right? Something, you know, we had so many $100,000 in the bank, and now we don't. Rinpoche would be upset, right? He would not say, due to his role, due to his compassion with others, he would not say, well, money comes and money goes, no big deal, right? Let's just let the thief or let the Bank of India have it. No, they're going to go look for it, right? Are we clear? Yeah. Because he knows that without the money in the bank, they won't be able to draw out any money to buy food for the monks. They're not just going to... It's going to be worrisome. So, the fourth, and then we'll meditate. For the view which has the three vital points, meditation, the union of wisdom and love, is accomplished by the action common to all the bodhisattvas. Were all the Buddhas of past, present, and future to confer, no instruction would they find greater than this, brought out as a treasure from the depth of transcendent insight by the Tirthon of Dharmakaya, the inner power of Rigpa, nothing like ordinary treasures of earth and stone, for it is the final testament of Gaub Dorje, the essence of the wisdom mind of the three transmissions. It is entrusted to my heart disciples, sealed to be secret. It is profound in meaning, my heart's words. It is the words of my heart, the crucial key point. The crucial point, never hold it cheap. Never let this instruction slip away from you. This is the special teaching of the wise and glorious King. So, very nice teaching from Patrimche. Easy. Yes. The translator, I'm not sure who the translator is. Yeah, this nice wisdom and love, or wisdom and compassion. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes, you know, like we get into these tropes in Dharma, like it's got to be always wisdom and compassion. Well, it's Karuna, but also Maitri. I mean, it's passionate. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, 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 yeah. This translation is from Lotsawa House, which has some really nice translations. Yeah. Yeah. Look at the nature of your lived experience. Decide this is it. When the essence of mind expresses itself a little strongly, and just recognize this is a wave. Okay? So let's practice. I'm going to teach you Dzogchen mantra. So sometimes you can end or start, you know, with three ahs. Lots of times, of course, goes along with visualizing Tibetan letter A, and, or, you know, kind of a rainbow tile. but it's just good to say, ah. And it's good to follow up with, ah, so you did it that way. you know. There's a lot of good mantra at that. It's ah, hmm. You know. Oh. But ah, you did it that way. Hmm. So ah, just ah, comes from heart center. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break again. Always in the break, you maintain Vajra pride, being Sambhogakaya, Buddha Bodhisattva. But the pride means that you're being helpful royalty. Isn't that nice? Yeah, kind of going, yeah, I have all my jewels on and my titles and my badges and, you know, I'll hold the door for you, or I'll let you take my seat, or I'll pick up this piece of trash, or I'm willing to be inconvenienced by you, right? That's Bodhisattva practice. Huh? It's not just doing good on our own time. It's like, I'm willing to be inconvenienced by you as I help you out. So, okay, Bodhisattva royalty, see you 10 minutes, huh? In our tradition, of course, we rely upon our own experience and practice, but we also, you know, rely on our teachers and scripture and logic, right? So it's also traditional for a teacher to say, okay, well, I'm giving a teaching on this and this, and you know, I'm consulting this person, that person, or this text. So, the two books that I enjoy, we have many books on Mahamudra and Dzogchen, but the ones that I've found most useful and have used for today is a book by Kyabgon Rinpoche, or Trelleg Rinpoche, called Mind at Ease. So, called Mind at Ease, Self-Liberation Through Mahamudra Meditation. he passed away a little bit early before I had a chance to meet him or study with him like 5 or 6 years ago. Exceptionally well-educated and compassionate teacher. So that's called Mind at Ease, and with a foreword by Trungpa Rinpoche. So nice overview of like history and direct experience at the same time. So Mind at Ease, Self-Liberation Through Mahamudra Meditation by Trelleg Kyabgon. So it looks like this. I don't know if we have a copy in the library or not. So he goes through the four yogas of Mahamudra and ground, path, and fruition Mahamudra. Even though we can't get realization by reading, we can sure get confusion by not reading. So, you know, we honor the finger pointing at the moon, particularly if it's pointing in the right direction. Then the Dzogchen book I like and used for my teaching on 3 points is just called Dzogchen, Heart Essence of the Great Perfection. So it's Dalai Lama. You have that, yeah. So I was very fortunate to be in San Jose in 1989 when he gave the empowerment for Padmasambhava, Guru Rinpoche, and eight manifestations, and that was San Jose in 1989. So it has that chapter. So it also has questions, and Dalai Lama's obviously wisdom and compassion is immense, so a good overview. Many books on Dzogchen, they're all good in a way, but these are like, you know, if you have to get one, this is what I'm doing. looks so young here. Look at the picture. Of course, 1989, we're all younger. One of the, it's not exclusively on Dzogchen and Mahamudra, but there's a very famous book, Kindness, Clarity, and Insight, a collection of his lectures, and one of the last chapters is a thing called Unity of the Four Schools or something. He gives this remade presentation of the different Tibetan schools. There are very few teachers that could kind of say, well, let's compare, you know, Rigpa used in this sense and Rigpa over here. Let's compare, you know, Yeshe when it's used here. Usually Yeshe is kind of like primordial wisdom, but sometimes it's this, you know. So there are very few people that could kind of just say, okay, this is how it all works. So before we do our final meditation, maybe some discussion or questions or complaints. Usually there's somebody that raises their hand and says, I just don't get it. But no one's done that yet, unfortunately, yet. I don't think they would. Yeah, definitely. Scary when this one person did. you're always opening, you know, you're in a monastic situation particularly, but in front of one's teacher, you're always kind of... But, you know, sometimes you have to just kind of put it out there and just say, well, this has been my experience, and this has been where I am. You know, you have to do that, you know, knowing that you're not going to always get instant validation, you know. You might go, oh, Lhasa, you know. But, you know, it's not their role to do that, generally. To say, that's good, you know, they'll just say, more work. But nevertheless, we should bring our experiences, because a lot of times, this is a good question, a lot of times we actually have genuine experiences, but we dismiss them. And you know, we think, well, I'm letting go of it. But no, it should be recognized and then built on. And maybe sometimes they're even really genuine realizations. We really have, you know, incorporated something into our life, and we need the mirror and the feedback on that. So in our tradition, you know, we always check in with our teacher. We don't, you know, just keep it to ourselves like that. That makes sense, right? It can be kind of embarrassing sometimes. But it can also be really confirming and validating, and it's necessary, and it isn't, it's necessary as human beings to mostly get that kind of feedback. We need to look in the mirror and kind of check. Yeah. Hello?
When you were talking about point one, actual lived experience?
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
Well, what's your lived experience right now? Our lived experience right now, like either you're talking or I'm listening, you're moving your hand, you're writing.
What would be a not actually?
Most of our non-lived experiences are a huge amount of explanation and commentary. Because we're just habituated to, you know, refer to our commentary. So, kind of the echo. You know, or thinking about it. Thinking can be lived experience, but usually we get caught in, you know, thinking about our thinking. We get caught in our explanation. We get caught in our kind of overview, that which is like a film. But when we're saying actual lived experience, we're really thinking what's going on right now. But, and, you know, we can bring forth memories, and somebody's asked us about something, and we can bring, it doesn't always have to be, you know, just right now I'm blinking, you know, and that's all my, you know, our, as we go deeper and deeper, our actual lived experience is the three times, right? So I get annoyed with Eckhart Tolle fanaticists who say, well, you know, this just, you know, this is just the now. Well, this is the now, but it's the long now. So, with a certain amount of insight, we could say, well, you know, the now was my childhood experience too, right? And many people can recall with more vividness their childhood experience, their first experience of something, and can bring that forth. So in a way, we can say that's our lived experience too, because it's still alive to us, rather than just like memory, you know? So when you're talking to somebody that is in touch with a whole you know, flow of experience, it doesn't have to be like now, like, folks, it's all now, you know, we just call, we have now, we have past now, we have future now. But even if you say now, people will, you know, will go into their head and give explanation. So that's not a cure if you're just thinking now is clock time. Clock time, one way to talk about now, but our actual lived experience you know, the whole span of our life. It's just not our explanation about it. For example, like I've told before, like in couples therapy, usually people are kind of upset with each other, and it's kind of maybe a little stereotypical, but the wife will say, I don't feel any love for you anymore from you, or I don't think you love me anymore. And the husband will say, I've told you a million times I love you. That would not be actual lived experience of love, would it? You know I love you, you know? So that's like an explanation, right? Or, you know, I bought you a new vacuum cleaner for your birthday. I love you, you know? True quotes. Yeah. You know, a more loving thing might be a loving smile or a loving gesture, or, you know, like that, right? A lived experience. It's hard when we're feeling defensive, you know, we kind of go into our head and scramble. But a lot of people's childhood, as well as their future, is very alive for them. and they can draw on that and express that. So we can't just say our actual lived experience is just the now clock time, because then how long is the now clock time? Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, our senses are so distorted and restricted driving. It's kind of a disassociative experience in a lot of ways. We're not, yeah. Yeah. There's Zen and the art of driving, however. Motorcycle man's, yeah. Yeah, so generally in our tradition, we want to wait. When all the senses are completely woken up, then all the senses become Buddhas, right? You have eye sense Buddha, smell sense Buddha, hearing sense Buddha, right? They become the Buddhas, the senses. Yeah. Yes.
You were talking about single pointedness.
Yeah.
Also being your elusive fixation.
Yeah.
It seems the two words to me seem like they're kind of the same thing, so I was hoping you could just talk about that. The single pointedness, but not fixating.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of metaphor, of course, you know, so it's kind of a dangerous metaphor because. In English, it kind of goes to this kind of, like we kind of drill down and funnel on something. So the single point really metaphor is like you want to be a needle so you can go through all that, you know, the cloth, whereas a needle with two points, you've got a problem, you get stuck. We hear a single point and we kind of go, you know, like too much like that. But it basically means, in a sense, non-distracted, like that. Shamatha, for example, is, you know, like a really single-pointed concentration. So, like your mind, your attention can rest somewhere. And it's just fully present. Doesn't want to be. I call it. You don't want to be anywhere else. Just emotionally, with single pointed. You're just like, I'm really happy just to be, you know, looking at this thing or thinking about this thing or being with this person. I'm not thinking, when is this going to be over? That wouldn't be single pointed, right? So you're really just kind of happy to be present with it. So in shamatha, there's always this sense of kind of bliss. I got a real compliment from one of my professors in grad school after he graded our MMPIs. I don't know if people know, that's a really old psych test, MMPI, and it tests for a whole bunch of usual deficiencies, but you know, wrote back. He said you tested really high for, you know, tolerance of boredom. So he said you'd be really happy watching paint dry. He knew I was a Dharma practitioner, so you just kind of, you don't really want to change your experience in one-pointedness, but it's not lazy, it's still energized. But the 2 points, you see, the metaphor is you'd be going in 2 different directions. But we hear it kind of as funneling down. Don't you hear it? I hear it that way. When you say one-pointed, you know, you kind of like funnel in and like, you know, locked and loaded on something. But, you know, just means you really don't have another, you know, thing running. No, it's not. We tend to see one point as fixation. You know, we tend to kind of, when you tell people normally to concentrate, they kind of make their brow kind of, they get tighten their jaw or something, and you know, yeah, they fixate. So we train probably that way in school as kids. So it's kind of hard to untrain to it sometimes. That's what we're, a big part of sitting meditation is training to have like an open gaze that at the same time is non-distracted. Because we're used to this kind of trauma funneling thing, you know. That's what happens in flight and fight. The visual field tends to be tunneled, you know, tend to be restricted. So, in particularly in Dzogchen Hema Mudra, we're not hyper-focusing on one thing. We're just like, I call it listening gaze. Like, we're just kind of sitting here, and we're open to the room, but we're not particularly focusing on anything visually or focusing on any thought, right? That's why we say the mind rests on nothing, just like space. Or, ironically, the joke is, you know, rest in the natural state. You know, the room goes, well, where's the frickin' natural state? Well, the natural state is you don't have to rest on anything. There's nothing to rest on, and you don't have to rest on anything because we are the space. In fact, we're everything we experience, so no need to go anywhere, right? No need to escape. For the whole world, then what's there to worry about? There's nothing you can meet that isn't your own experience. Nothing you can meet that isn't your own experience. If it isn't your own experience, if you can't meet it, you can't experience it, then what is it? Concept. Yes.
What I thought of for the first time ever, talking about resting without a ground, it never occurred to me before, but it seemed like an 8,000 line across in front of the sutra, right there at the beginning of it, if I recall correctly, and I might not, that's what it's a question. But when he's talking about the bodhisattva courses, in this knowledge of emptiness without fear, mm-hmm. without ground, I can't remember the exact it's not like I was prepared to talk about it, but it seems like it echoes to that really strongly, mm-hmm. in the way that it never did when I heard these teachings before. Do you think that's valid? Or?
Yeah. It's been a while since I read the Asta, but, you know, I'll get back to it. No, that's okay. Asta Prajnaparamita Sutta, Asta means 8,000, you know. Yeah, of course, you know, all the Mahamudra and Dzogchen teachings, you know, the Buddha taught from the very beginning, you know, we're just using maybe different languages or putting different emphasis, you know, depending upon the skillful means of the audience. But definitely, like in Diamond Sutra of Vajracchedika, you know, it's like the Bodhisattva, you know, produces a mind that rests on nothing. Yeah. So we always want to have some kind of substratum, you know, so that's very, very deep, and you know, we always believe there's got to be something underneath or behind the experience to kind of give it structure, right? So that's the majority of religions and philosophies. They're all like, there's something behind it that kind of gives it structure or value, kind of like, you know, this gold bars in the back of the dollars, which they're not. So we're just always looking for that. And the Buddha said, you know, there's nothing behind the experience, guys. You know? So that's actually good news, you know? So there's nothing binding us. There's nothing hidden. There's nothing like, it's just, it's all right here. But it's so freaking obvious, we don't believe it at first. We kind of go, no, that can't be true. That's too easy. Can't make money off of that, you know? So we think that there's something behind it.
So we're actually free.
We're actually free. You know, so, yeah. So we could all, you know, just quit right now, but but we stay around because we realize, actually, even with a little bit of insight, that it feels good to have it and we can expand it. And, you know, then we realize there are many people that we love and care for, and many people we don't even know that are really, really stuck and suffering. And, you know, we want to learn the skillful means to work with it, you know. So that spontaneous compassion, you know, is an expression of awareness and Rigpa and Yeshe, so. But it is weird. Life is weird. It's really weird, you know. Yeah, okay. Oh, hi, yeah. You know, as far as our karma goes, it's both and. You see, we have the motivation, and we're creating the action, which has the result. So, what we've done, we can kind of look back and reflect. So it looks like it's just kind of there, and it looks predetermined. It's not, but because we've made it, then it's there. You know. Somebody made the building here, and then we painted it, so it's here. So, in a sense, it looks like, well, I was predetermined, but it's not at any point. That could get a little New Agey, where, you know, say, everyone just creates their own space and blah, blah. You know, Rigpa and Yeshe and fundamental mind is not created by anybody. You see, so when we say created and dissolution, you know, dissolved, that's relative truth. Emptiness and interdependence, you know, it's not born and it's not dying. So, you know, we Buddhists don't kind of go, well, that's your karma, you screwed up, so eat it. You know, we don't do that. There's no determinism. But, you know, once you've created a karmic path, it takes work to change it, you know. There's no instant. And there are different karmic paths, so. Yeah. Yeah. And, okay. Maybe we can end with a sitting. Yeah. Before we do our prayers and dedication, just a quick review. our tradition, it's the foundation and the preparation is essential. If you want to build a pyramid that's high, you need a broad foundation. So when starting practice, even if you're starting before the morning, you still have kind of zero state, right? Which in a way is just kind of complete Rigpa and Nyesha, you're just kind of there, but we're just starting there, zero, and then we're doing our dream and reverie, our nine breaths, our energy work. When I say nine breaths, you know, doing the energy work, and then we're doing the prayers, and then, you know, we're sitting. Or it could be energy, sitting, prayers, energy, but we're doing those preparations, so, and reading too. So we've covered our energetic side, we've covered our mind side, we've covered intellectual side. You know, we've traversed that part of the mandala. So when we're ready to do direct recognition of mind, we're prepared. A lot of times people, well, like I was, maybe still am, like, I don't want to read the directions. I just want to do it. So I just want to sit. I don't want to, you know, read all this stuff and do the prayers. I just want to sit. It was humbling to realize it actually helped to have some structure, read the books, to develop the aspiration and do the energy work. You know, I was under the impression that real yogis just kind of sit on the cushion and it just kind of works itself out. Well, maybe after eons, and monkeys will, you know, compose Shakespeare, but we're you know, just like on the typewriter, like ding, ding, ding. You know, Vajrayana is supposed to be, you know, the fast track, so we, you know, want to get her done, you know, if we can. It takes more discipline, and in some sense it's riskier. The discipline is, yeah, we've got all these practices we want you to do, you know, but we're doing a lot anyway. We're brushing her teeth, and then we feed the cat, and then we brush our hair. You know, we're doing a lot of things anyway. Where the other practice is, you know, just sit, and, you know, gradually your Buddha mind will manifest. They're slower. They're safer, but they're slower, okay? And you may not even get that high realization. You know, you're just kind of sitting, and things will bubble up, and, you know, like, you can't just mess with much of you just literally just sitting there. No prayers, no energy work, no teacher particularly, or, you know, you're just sitting. It's fine, but it's slow. So in Vajrayana, we do emphasize some steady. We particularly emphasize heavy-duty energy work, doing the inner yogas, doing things that really turbocharge the Mahayana tradition. You know, Guru Yoga and Salung practices, you know, things like that are turbocharged practices. So that when we do kind of a direct recognition practice, direct liberation practice like Mahamudra and the Dzogchen, like, we're prepared. When we jump off the diving board, you know, we've trained. I don't know, that's our tradition. So as we gradually get time, then we can increase our space of sitting, right? But that's because we've created the right foundation through motivation and so forth. That's easy, right? Makes sense? So I think if you sat for eons, then gradually, or maybe along many long lifetimes, gradually things would bubble up. But not necessarily. Frogs sit a long time, right? So then maybe frogs already realized on some level, but it looks like we do more in Vajrayana, but the motivation, in my experience, is that the realization is faster and deeper. Honestly, I'm just putting a little pitch for our school here. You know, the incredible teachers of all the schools I've met have done a lot of practice and study and energy work, and they have a lot of energy. They do a lot of stuff, you know, and have a lot of bodhicitta, and it pays off. It works. So that's why I'm promoting it, because this stuff works, you know. So I'm gung-ho today. Anyway, are you leading prayers? No? Turuko? That means you're... Oh, okay. No, is that... Good. So I have another hour for some short darshans interviews. I like meeting people. Honestly, 10 minutes is probably what you would get at the monastery with the High Lamas every 6 months. But, you know, that can work too. People really prepare, you see. It's not casual. You know, people really prepare and they sort things out and really get to the essence of what they need to hear. And, you know, so sometimes that's it, you know. But I'm going to hang out in Tara office, and I'll see some of you soon and others later, and it'll be good. Yeah. Tudache, thank you.